Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. This week, the story of Anwar Ibrahim.
They say timing is everything in politics, and Malaysia's Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi is planning to use an early election to his advantage.
He hasn't given any particular reason for the snap poll, but it stymies any chance that Anwar Ibrahim will be able to take part. Dr. Anwar is just 6 weeks shy from being able to re-enter politics after the 1999 conviction against him for corruption.
To many in the international community, Anwar Ibrahim is a beacon of democracy and modernity in Malaysia, and his conviction for corruption, a miscarriage of justice. To Australians, he is best known as the politician who fell out with the Malaysian Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, in 1998, and ended up in court on sodomy and corruption charges. Most of us will remember the image of his blackened eye as he entered the court defiantly protesting his innocence. Anwar won't be standing in the election next weekend, but his political influence will be felt. Since his release from jail in 2004, he has been working behind the scenes, trying to forge an alliance between Malaysia's disparate opposition groups. Groups as diverse as radical Islamists and human rights activists, in an attempt to undermine the political power of his old party, UMNO, who have ruled Malaysia for the past 50 years. Yet during the 1980s and 90s, Anwar was an active member of Mahathir's UMNO government. First as a minister and later as deputy prime minister, he played a critical role in the process of the Islamisation of Malaysia. In Rear Vision today, the twists and turns of Anwar Ibrahim. Anwar was 10 years old when Malaysia gained its independence in 1957. It was a time of great excitement, especially for the Malay community, who believed that they were going to regain political and economic control over the new nation. Anwar Ibrahim.
Both my parents were in Kuala Lumpur. They left us to join the celebrations. We had our own independence because our parents were we.
And did you understand it at all at that stage?
Well, not much, except the fact that we, the Malayans then, are supposed to decide everything and rule this country and improve and all for the better.
Your parents were clearly fairly political. Was that the kind of grounding in the kind of politics that you grew into, or where do you get your sense of politics from?
Yeah, without doubt, my parents, they read non-Malaysian literature, biography of the Prime Minister. My father, of course, quotes Shakespeare quite a bit in his speeches. You know, it's interesting because the level of proficiency of the English language was far superior than among the middle-class Malays. My mother, of course, is more comfortable with Malay and Indonesian, so we have familiarity with Indonesian novels and literature. But, of course, I follow some of the speeches, all talking about independence, about education, about survival. So I think that was the initial education and exposure to politics.
Johan Saravanamuttu, visiting senior research fellow at the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, argues that the young Anwar had two main political influences.
Anwar, of course, you cannot say he's absolutely from a rural area, although if you go to his hometown, which is in a place called Cherot Tokkun, on the mainland side of the Penang state, it is very rural, but he did go to a school which was in an urban environment called the Bukit Matajam High School. Growing up as a young man, I think he would have been influenced by two kinds of forces. One is his Islamic roots, the rural sort of base of Malaysian Malays, and also the interaction that he would have had with some urbanites, many of them were non-Malays, in Bukit Matajam, in the school that he went to. That would have been his kind of background.
Anwar went to university in Kuala Lumpur at the end of the 60s. It was a time of great student activism and social unrest in Malaysia.
Well, I entered the university in 67, 68. I could sense a lot of disillusionment, very strong anti-establishment view among the Malays. They don't feel secure. They think that all this promise of independence was starting to slide downwards, and leaders were just living in the state of denial. and we don't consider them to represent the conscience of the majority. So we took it upon ourselves then as students and presenting the conscience of the majority. Of course, at that time, we were exposed to, you know, Herbert Marcuse, Erik Erikson, and Frantz Fanon, Ivan Illich, and so on and so forth. So that has such a strong, powerful influence. And by the way, to me, I mean, it is not only exciting, but intellectually enlightening and stimulating. But that was a generation when you were just reason to be disillusioned and frustrated. But then you're exposed to, you know, such rich wealth of thought and ideas. And at the same time, there was this Ho Chi Minh, this Che Guevara. And we had also some exposure because we were active student leaders who were picked up to attend some of the international students and youth meetings, having to be exposed to Latin Quarter and London. And that was interesting.
By the time he entered university, he went to University of Malaya, and he did Malay studies, right? And at that point of time, he'd become very politicized. By the second year, I believe, he'd already been the president or the person who led the Malay Language Society and also joined the Malaysian Muslim Students Organization or Association. So he had become politicized. And the kinds of things that he fought for very much reflected what you said about Malays being an underclass. He was fighting for Malays whom he thought had not, you know, after how many years of independence, had not really attained or achieved what they'd hoped for. There was no Malay middle class to speak of. Malays were still very poor.
Malaysia begins the 1970s in a second state of emergency that shows signs of becoming the dominating feature of the decade ahead. The new emergency is the result of the race riots which broke out following the elections last May. Too much wealth is in the hands of one race, the Chinese. Dramatic changes are being demanded by the young, the poor, the landless, the unemployed, and particularly by the Malays, who feel they should have a greater share of the national wealth to match their political power.
After 69 riots, and I took over as the dominant student, Malay student grouping then, we just started taking issues on poverty, corruption, neglect, etc., rural health problems, education, language, and of course the craving for identity. We thought that we have lost that. Then came about the infamous Baling riots or demonstrations, farmers' protests in Kedah, at the time when rubber prices were very low. And I was detained without trial for 2 years.
Anwar was one of a number of student activists arrested in 1974 under the infamous Internal Security Act.
The way it was used shocked us because we thought, as proponent of the Malay agenda at that time, talking about corruption, abuse of power, rural poverty, we thought government would be less intolerant as compared to the communist or pro-communist activists. But in order to rationalize, it's interesting that one of the reasons I was detained is that I was a pro-communist. I was not even a communist, I was not even a pro-communist, but a pro-communist, for whatever it means. But for being a pro-communist, you are landed in jail without trial for 2 years.
He was, in a way, somebody who today we'll say was a civil society activist. However, I think his politics was very much still steeped in Malay culture, Malay politics, and the concerns of the Malays at that point of time. And I would add sort of a new emerging force, which was Islam. In the 1970s, there was a strong revivalism of Islam. A lot of young people had been fired by some of the writings of the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt, you know, writers like Hassan al-Banna, also Maududi from Pakistan and so on. So they infuse a strong element of Islam in their struggle for social justice. That was a kind of political climate on which Anwar became a politicized person. And that's where he also began to make alliances with the young Turks in UMNO, such as Mahathir Mohamad, who was also very critical of the, you know, elitist politics of UMNO at that point of time and felt that the old guard of UMNO had not really done enough for the Malays to uplift their economic situation, etc.
Clive Kessler is Emeritus Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of New South Wales and one of Australia's foremost Malaysia watchers.
More than half the Malay vote in 1969 was corralled by the Islamic Party, capitalising, mobilising, drawing upon the dissatisfactions with the disappointments of independence, the disappointments of Merdeka. But the Islamic Party in those days was not as it is now. It wasn't an Islamist, Sharia-minded Islamic. It was a mixture of three things. Some were ulama, were religious leaders. Some were Malay nationalists with a view to Indonesia-Malaya solidarity. And others were kind of populist social, not quite socialist, but social populists. But as a result of 1969, first of all, the Islamic Party joined the governing coalition, and as a result of its co-option, it lost popular credibility. And out of resentment at that, this new leadership group emerged who were coming in particular from the University of Malaya and from Abim, from the same background as Anwar, who said, no, we've got to have a real serious, proper Islamist Malay politics, Sharia-minded politics. Now, Anwar rode that, Anwar was part of that, and a lot of people from that background moved straight from that student Islamist politics into the Islamic Party, who took it over from the old guard and have made the Islamic Party this very Sharia-minded Islamic law, hooded punishment kind of party. Now, at that time, everybody said Anwar is probably going to go into politics. He's not going to stay with this. And everybody assumed that Anwar was going to go into Islamist politics, into Islamic Party. But he took a different turn.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web with me, Annabelle Quince. And in today's program, we're examining the political career of Anwar Ibrahim. Next political move shocked almost everyone. In 1983, he joined the new UMNO government of Dr. Mahathir.
It was a surprise to many people, including some of us who were considered ourselves sort of working with civil society on issues of academic freedom and so on. And I think the main sort of reason or the factor that got this to happen must have been Mahathir Mohamad, the new prime minister. He had just become the Prime Minister of Malaysia in 1981, and very soon after that, he decided to ask Anwar to join. The conventional wisdom, I mean, on this is that it was quite clear that Mahathir wanted Anwar for his Islamic credentials because the UMNO was under considerable political challenge from the Islamic Party PAS at that point of time. PAS was becoming a fairly significant. And one of the ways they thought they could meet this challenge was to get somebody like Anwar, because UMNO itself didn't have too many people who had those kinds of credentials. So that's one of the reasons he was co-opted. The other reason was, I guess, because if you can't meet them, you get them to join you. You know, so Anwar is becoming a bit of a thorn in the side of the government, even in those days. So that was the reason why he was invited. I guess, and from the Anwar perspective, he saw this as an opportunity to change from the inside, saw this as an opportunity to, you know, get his ideas implemented, because perhaps at that point of time, being a political realist, he felt that he couldn't do these things outside of the ruling coalition and the ruling UMNO party.
Mahathir came in with a clear agenda, strong on anti-corruption, strong on separation of powers, strong on the reform agenda, clear on this issue that the country needs change, poverty alleviation. And in my first statement with him, I said that there was this understanding, number one, on, you know, clear agenda on poverty and on issue of governance. And of course, I say infusion of positive Islamic values in terms of ethics, work ethics in the government, which then was agreed. So I thought I came in with that agenda. I was right in some ways, but not always.
That might have been a rationalization if he really believed that. Then he had an inadequate political appreciation of what he was up against. Mahathir wanted everything about modernity, economic, technological, social, as long as you didn't have to have human rights, any of that kind of stuff. He wanted everything about modernity except cultural modernity. You know, he was really very, you know, familistic, conventional. And so I think it would have been very naive of Anwar to have imagined that he could do that. And well, he tried, but failed. But I think it goes to another thing. It's not just that he was naive politically. I mean, it goes to Anwar's weakness. I mean, he has these ambitions and aspirations that Anwar may wish to see himself and to be seen as something of a Renaissance man, a great cosmopolitan. In Malaysian terms, he may be, but he's less a deep thinker and cosmopolitan than an eclectic, dilettante wannabe intellectually. He is, as all good people in politics are, a combination of an idealist and an opportunist, but the opportunist is a better opportunist than the idealist is a thinker, let's put it that way.
Anwar moved quickly up the political ranks and by the end of the 1980s became a major force behind Mahathir's Islamization program.
On gaining power in 1982, Dr. Mahathir noted that the new economic plan was failing to give the Malays any real sense of national identity. So he tapped into the worldwide Islamic resurgence. Malay nationalism became synonymous with Islam. An Islamic university was established and an Islamic bank. 10 years ago, Malaysia didn't have the feel of an Islamic country. Now Islamic institutions dominate Malay life.
One of the things that was introduced by the Mahathir government was Islamization. None of this had actually happened in any sort of a thoroughgoing fashion prior to his coming the prime minister. So it was under his tenure that the Islamization policies of the government went full hilt. And by that, we mean not that Malaysia became an Islamic state, but there were all these institutions set up and allowing for, I think, a Islamic bureaucracy to then embed itself within the Mahathir government. And this Islamic bureaucracy now has become one of the major players, I think, in my view, in extending and in reinforcing Sharia in Malaysia. And of course, the whole Islamization thing in terms of economics, Islamic banking, setting up of IKIM, which is a kind of an institute which promotes the idea of Islam being universal. And the setting up of the UIA, which was Anwar's pet project, the University Islam Malaysia. So all of those things happened in the 80s under Mahathir and with Anwar there as his sort of right-hand person with respect to Islam.
I was very pleased with my housing schemes. If you can see around Kuala Lumpur, most of the public housing schemes were schemes introduced when I was finance minister. These were, of course, success stories, which I consider partly at least successful education, public health programs. And of course, a more liberal sort of exchange. For example, we had a series of programs through some of civil society groups that I supported on social justice. Can you imagine a very conservative party having open discussions on the social justice agenda in every province in this country? And I thought that was, moving within the limited boundaries that we had. I mean, a lot of excesses, no? There were a lot of people detained under the ISA, meanwhile, you know. But that was, of course, I think something which is to me very enriching. But there were failures, for example. The only statement I could make in Parliament was that it is time that we at least amend some section of the ISA, which was vehemently opposed by some in the party and clearly by the then Inspector General of Police. And the issue of there was creeping corruption, I would have thought that I could have done more, but there were limits. But my friends, some of the cynical ones among intellectuals and the media, would say that you should have done more. I said, yes, I could have done more. It would have been sacked earlier.
Well, the only agenda he did bring in was this counter-Islamization, which has just moved the whole UMNO onto the same ground as the Islamic Party to the point that now, and that's the big issue in the current election, is where the government's finally said, it doesn't stand on any different ground than the Islamic Party, than the Islamists. Anwar said wonderful things about, because he has a sense, you know, what the role of the Minister of Education was and should be, what was needed. And there was going to be a restoration, there was going to be, you know, reform of the university, someone was going to restore the rights of academics, this and that. And all the people who work very, very closely with him are very, very bitter.
A lot of people actually are very critical of Anwar. His friends or the people who supported him, I think, including ABIM leaders and so on, basically take the view that he became corrupted by being part of this whole UMNO politics, began to like it, enjoy it, you know. But if you look at his record, I think, one can't really pin him down. In terms of what he did or did not do, one of the things I thought that's often forgotten, one of the things that he did do when he was given the opportunity to be acting prime minister, when Mahathir went away for a number of months, he was acting prime minister, he introduced the Anti-Corruption Act. And there are some opinions that Anti-Corruption Act was thought to be very threatening. And this Anti-Corruption Bill or Act possibly may have been seen as something that would be used against his political enemies. And his political enemies set upon him when they had the opportunity and it came in the financial crisis.
Early this morning, Malaysia's ruling UMNO party withdrew Anwar Ibrahim's membership.
As UMNO's chiefs met, the crowd backing Anwar swelled to more than 1,000.
Malaysia is in its deepest political crisis in decades, and the climax of the Commonwealth Games has run a poor second place to the spectacle of balaclava-wearing troopers smashing their way into a news conference to arrest the former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim.
Anwar's arrest and trial ignited street protests in Malaysia that were unprecedented. And while his political influence diminished during the 6 years he was in prison, since his release in 2004, he has acted as a middleman between Malaysia's disparate opposition parties. Parties as diverse as the Islamic Party PAS, the secular Chinese Party, the Democratic Action Party, and his own multiracial People's Justice Party.
I think he will continue to be an influence. At the moment, the DAP, which is the Democratic Action Party, is unwilling to go into a pact with the PAS because of the PAS's agenda for an Islamic State, which the DAP does not support. So Anwar has to act as a kind of in-between man to broker this whole election campaign and to engineer what is called one-on-one fights, right, in all the constituencies. So he's still a very key person and a point man in this whole opposition politics now.
My passion for freedom, as I said, is far stronger now than before I was arrested. My commitment to the reform agenda is far stronger. And I don't believe that things can be done through UMNO because so blatantly corrupt, undemocratic. So I think it is incumbent upon me and my friends to be able to energize the public to say that, look, something needs to be done. I have never wavered on my position in jail and now outside to continue the struggle.
Some people have accused him of being politically dishonest, that he's been a political chameleon. One could make a case, you know, he was an Islamist, then he joined UMNO, he became a Malay nationalist, you know, and now suddenly he's called for the, a multicultural Malaysian society. He's even asked that in the Malaysian universities that we should have, why can't we have a Chinese vice chancellor? But some people say he may have shifted his political ground quite a bit. If you take his political history as one which has been to champion social justice and to tackle issues of corruption, injustice, and also to champion the underclass. Taking it as a whole, I would say that he has remained fairly consistent as politicians can be. Can we say that?
That's the program for this week, and I'd like to thank my three guests, Johan Saravanamutu, Anwar Ibrahim, and Clive Kessler. Thanks also to sound engineer Lila Schooner and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and I hope you'll join us next week for Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.